nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so I think we can start. This is lecture 5 in this sequence of 6 lectures on scanning tunneling microscopy. This is the last lecture that we'll give that's devoted strictly to the STM. And what I thought I'd do today is discuss a few remaining topics, things that we kind of raced through during our discussions of about a week ago. I say they're advanced topics, but they're not really that advanced. They're just kind of interesting, and they're peculiar to scanning tunneling microscopes. So what I'm going to cover today is the scanning tunneling spectroscopy and the current imaging tunneling spectroscopy. These are two modes of STM that are widely used throughout the world. I like to talk a little bit about the apparent barrier height that characterizes this tunnel barrier between the tip and the substrate. I'd like to talk about how you measure that. I'd like to talk about the stability of the tip-substrate junction. When you bring a tip a few angstroms away from a surface and you apply an electric field between the tip and the substrate, the atoms on the tip are under high stress, and they may, in fact, move. So I'd like to give a little discussion about that. Talk about the height of an atom that you measure with a scanning tunneling microscope and how those heights compare to what you would expect experimentally or what you would expect theoretically. And then lastly, we'll talk a little bit about these quantum corrals, which are a really beautiful example of what scanning tunneling microscopy can do. Throughout this lecture, the main theme is that STM is more than just a technique to obtain atomic scale images. Right? If that's all it did, it would be wonderful. But by applying voltages to tips and sweeping the voltages in controlled ways, you can get information about surfaces that you can't get with any other technique. It's pure and simple. So you can go beyond the images, and you can start to get information that's of interest. So the scanning tunneling spectroscopy, it's referred to in the literature as STS. And it basically relies on the fact that the current that flows between the tip and the substrate is controlled by the bias voltage that you apply between the tip and the substrate. So under no bias, and if the work function of the tip happens to be equal to the work function of the substrate, you have the schematic diagram that we discussed a few lectures back. There's a potential barrier. The height of that potential barrier is referred to as phi. That's often known as the apparent barrier height. It should be somewhat related to the work function of a metal. The width of the barrier is d. That parameter D is on the order of a nanometer. It's probably a half a nanometer or so. And the question is, what happens when you apply a voltage between the tip and the substrate? So whenever you look at scanning tunneling spectroscopy, when you look at this in the literature, it's up to the author of the paper to tell you where the voltage is applied with respect to. Because the voltage could be applied with respect to the substrate, or the voltage could be applied with respect to the tip, right? And so when you see a plot of V versus I, you got to know what's at ground and where the potential is. So in this case, let's pretend that the voltage is applied to the tip. And that means that if you put a negative voltage on the tip with respect to the substrate, then you're going to push electrons from the tip into the substrate. That means that an electric field must develop between the tip and the substrate to promote that current flow. And the diagram on the left is appropriately modified, as I show on the right. And what you find is that electrons from that narrow box on the left underneath the word tip, those electrons tunnel through that potential barrier. arrive at the substrate, and when they arrive at the substrate, they find that there are no electron states occupied in that energy range. So the current can flow, and the current's going to basically flow just over the voltage range that you apply. So you have to turn voltage into an energy, so you do that by multiplying by the magnitude of the electronic charge. And so if you put, let's say, 100 millivolts between the tip and the substrate, you're going to get electron current flowing from 100 millivolts with respect to the Fermi energy of the substrate, right? It's just those states in that narrow range that are going to contribute to current flow. Because there's a transmission probability through that barrier, electrons at the top of the barrier are going to have a higher transmission probability than electrons at the bottom end of the barrier, right? So I indicate that by the thickness of the arrows, and it indicates that if you measure the total current that flows, in principle, the total current that flows is an integral over that energy range designated by EV, but in reality, the current tends to be dominated by the electrons that flow from the top energy levels of the tip into the empty energy states of the substrate. And then correspondingly, if you reverse the polarity of the voltage, what you do is you reverse the polarity of the current flow. You change the direction of the electric field between the tip and the substrate. And now electrons, and for the particular biasing that I've got set up, now electrons move from the substrate to the tip. And again, the electrons near the top end of the energy level of the substrate, near the Fermi level of the substrate, those electrons are going to dominate the current flow. And so the question is, with this simple physical picture in mind, what is the mathematics that you need to describe this process in more detail? And to go through that, I pick up on a discussion that we had maybe two or three lectures ago. I'm a little bit more specific now, right? In particular, it's the local density of states that's going to control the current flow. Local density of states could be influenced by many, many, many things. We've sort of schematically sketched out what could affect local density of states, things like adsorbates, impurity atoms, reconstruction of the substrate surface. All those things could affect the local density of states. And the local density of states could vary with energy in a very, very non-uniform way, and I've tried to indicate that schematically in this diagram. If you're going to measure the total current, then you need a formula that calculates what that total current flow is. And I indicate that formula underneath this cartoon. It's basically an integral over all energies. It's a convolution between the density of states of the tip and the density of states of the substrate. It requires you to know the transmission probability is a function of energy for electrons to tunnel through that barrier. That's what this T of E is, T of E and V. And then lastly, you have this difference in Fermi functions, this quantity in the square brackets that basically describes whether a state is filled on the left and whether it's empty on the right, right? So you cannot tunnel, electrons cannot tunnel from a filled state to a filled state because of the Fermi-Dirac distribution rules. Nor can an electron tunnel from an empty state into an empty state because if the state is empty, there's no electron there. So you have to build into the formalism a term that describes where the electrons are occupied, where they're empty, and that's described by that term in the brackets. The difference in the Fermi functions between the electrons on the left and the electrons on the right. Now, to make some progress, we need to make a few reasonable assumptions. Right? The first reasonable assumption is that at room temperature, we have to understand what the value of KT is in terms of energy. And so KT is about 25 millielectron volts at room temperature, 300 Kelvin. And that just means that if you're doing a bias voltage sweep, where you're changing the voltage, delta V, between the tip and the substrate, if you change that voltage by an amount that's greater than the thermal energy, KT, of the problem, then you can probably approximate that Fermi-Dirac function by a step function, okay? And that makes the resulting integral much easier. The other thing that we tend to do is we assume that the tip density of states does not change appreciably with energy. That's, again, another assumption. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to bring out the tip density of states from the integral, right? Because most people don't know what that density of states is anyway, right? So as a matter of practical operation, if you don't know what it is, you pretend it's a constant and you move it out of the integral. The other approximation that's usually made is that you approximate the transmission probability through that barrier as some constant number, independent of energy, even though in your heart you know it depends on energy. But if you don't know the shape of the barrier in detail, you can't calculate what T is as a function of energy, right? So what you tend to do is you tend to approximate T by some average transmission probability. You move that in out of the integral, and what you're left with after these three approximations, one approximation is on the Fermi function, second approximation is on the density of states of the tip, third approximation is on that transmission probability. What you're left with then, for instance, is an integral that just takes into account the density of states of the substrate, and you're integrating the density of states of the substrate over an energy range, which is determined by the voltage, by the bias voltage that you apply between the tip and the substrate. So you're left with that integral on the second line of this slide. It follows that if you take the slope of the current voltage curve. So if you take the derivative of I with respect to V at a particular voltage V, it follows that that derivative is proportional to the density of states of the substrate times some constants, which should remain reasonably fixed over the course of an experiment, especially if your bias voltage sweep is low. Okay? So that is the fundamental reason why this scanning tunneling spectroscopy is so useful, because just by measuring the current voltage, current is a function of voltage, and taking a simple derivative, in principle, you're left with a quantity that depends on, that's proportional to density of states of the substrate. Okay? So that's why it's used all the time. Yeah, there's a question.
So the local density of the state of the tip does not change with energy. This is an assumption. What about if the voltage was applied to the tip, so the electrons flowed from the substrate to the tip?
So the question is, what happens if you change the polarity of the voltage? Do these approximations still hold? And there's no reason why they shouldn't, right? Technically, these approximations are pretty good for small bias voltages, right? But and it doesn't matter what the polarity of the current is. I understand that. But you're just, so when the electrons flow from the substrate to the tip, right, what you're starting to do now is you're starting to probe, you're in this bottom right-hand panel, right? You're starting to probe in principle, the empty states of the tip, but more importantly, you're starting to probe the filled states of the substrate, right? So the main difference when you switch polarities of voltages is now you look at, for one polarity of voltage, you're looking at the filled states of the substrate. For the other polarity of voltage, you're looking at the empty states of the substrate. And you're assuming that the density of states of the tip is the same for both cases. Now, that's probably pretty good if the tip ends in a single atom, right? Because then you've got a local state that's atomic-like in nature, and it's conducting the current from the tip to the substrate, or it's accepting the current from the substrate to the tip. Right? If your tip is more of an extended creature, right, then you got problems. Okay, then you got problems. Okay. So this is really useful, especially if there are energy gaps in the density of states of the substrate. I mean, I think this is where the technique is mostly applicable. So if you have a material, let's say a small metallic cluster that has just a few dozen atoms in it, right? The energy states of those atoms will not, of those cluster of atoms, those energy states will not be continuous with energy. And if you tunnel into those states, you might expect that your tunnel current is going to be influenced by whether there are whether there are electron states present, whether there are electron states absent. And where those energy states occur are going to be determined by the shape of the cluster and the atoms that comprise the cluster. They're also going to be controlled by the coupling of the cluster to the substrate. If the cluster is well coupled to the substrate, that will also influence where those energy states are. So it's really useful if you're looking for energy gaps in your substrate. A technique that takes advantage of the scanning tunneling spectroscopy is called current imaging tunneling spectroscopy. And you'll see CITS in the literature all the time. And it's important if you're doing STM, it's important for you to know what that means. And what that basically means is that if you're doing an image, a topographic image that covers a certain region in space, let's say X and Y, you can imagine dividing that region of space up into a sequence, into a grid of points. Now, the grid of points may not be the same grid of points that you use when you do the topography of the image. So if the image is, let's say, 256 by 256 pixels, right, the grid of points could be less than that. It could be, let's say, 64 by 64 pixels. And if you do a CITS experiment, what you do is at each of these points in this gridded region, you stop the tip from scanning and you perform a current voltage measurement while you're acquiring the topographic image. Okay, so what this allows you to do is it starts to allow you to map out now simultaneously with topography what the density of states, the local density of states of the substrate is, because from a current voltage curve, you can always back out or you can estimate a local density of states by just simply taking the derivative. We just demonstrated that. So the idea is that every point you take this current voltage curve and then you fixate, you look at a certain prescribed subset of bias voltages. They're indicated schematically by the dots on this red curve here. And at those dots, for instance, you might take derivatives to infer local density of states. And then what you can do is you can lay that derivative map on top of your topographical map using computer graphics, and you can start to see how the local density of states or how the slope of the IV curve at a particular bias voltage, how that varies over the entire image. Okay? So it's a great technique. The underlying assumption when you do a CITS image is there's no drift, right? There's no drift, right? So to acquire an STM image could take on the order of minutes. To acquire a CITS image, you're basically stopping the tip from scanning, and at each grid point, you're ramping the current and measuring, or you're ramping the voltage and measuring the current. So the time to acquire a CITS image could be considerably longer than the time required just to take an image. And so it implies that when you're at your last grid point in the CITS image, there's no drift between that grid point and the initial grid point that you used when you started the image. And that's a questionable assumption. Most scanning probe microscope images tend to drift. Sometimes they drift a lot. They certainly drift right after you turn the equipment on, right? So you have to let things stabilize before you do the CITS imaging. It becomes even more important. And for that reason, the CITS images are often done at low temperatures, 4 Kelvin. At 4 Kelvin, there's no drift in the microscope. Thermal expansion is essentially finished. At low temperatures, nothing expands or contracts. It's all happened, right? As you cool it down from room temperature, all the thermal contraction has occurred. Once you get to 4 Kelvin, things become very stable, and you can then take these CITS images for hours, and there's just a fraction of an angstrom drift between your initial grid point and your final grid point. Okay. How do you make it work? To make it work, you have to start to control the microscope, right? You no longer just raster the microscope and have a feedback loop to maintain a constant tunnel current. What you have to start to do is you have to start to think in terms of how to program the microscope to do what you want it to do. And in particular, for a CITS image, it requires you to periodically shut off your feedback loop, which is indicated on the upper panel of this slide. So you're turning your feedback loop on and off. And when the feedback loop is off, you're then ramping the bias voltage and measuring the tunnel current, right? And so that the combination of those two actions then allows you to get a current voltage curve at the preset data points that you've selected to do the IV measurements in the process of doing a CITS image. So this is like an advanced application in the sense that you have to write the software to do this. And of course, nowadays, this is a standard feature in most commercial STMs. So if you buy a commercial scanning tunneling microscope, they'll have a CITS option already built in. But in the early days, we had to figure out how to write a program and code it up and make sure everything was stable. But just an example of what's required to make these experiments work at some level. Is there an example of CITS in the literature? Yeah, there's a lot of them. I picked the website from the Omicron UHV STM to illustrate the case here. What you see in that panel is an exploded image of the silicon 111 surface that's been taken at different bias voltages. So the top image, the topmost image, is just the straight topography. That's acquired as you do a CITS experiment. That's automatic. And then underneath it, you see the image of the silicon 111 surface at different bias voltages. Okay. And those different bias voltages have been preset, and they're acquired in the process of they're acquired in the process of doing a CITS experiment. And so once you have those images, you can start to take derivatives of those images to find out local density of states at each particular bias voltage. And so you start to look at density of states of both filled and unfilled states on the silicon 111 surface. So if you sit down and think about it carefully, that's what you eventually get out of this. And you'll notice that the shape of the image for, let's say, a positive bias voltage is completely different than the shape of the image for a negative bias voltage, and that's just telling you local density of states has changed. Right? If the images acquired at different voltages looked exactly the same, then there would not be much of a change in density of states for the substrate with energy. The fact that they look different means there's changes. Okay, so that's CITS. Another really interesting question is how to measure the apparent barrier height of the tunnel barrier that connects the tip and the substrate. And so here I just remind you of some things that we've already discussed. We've talked that for a constant tip bias, we've discussed that current is related exponentially with the distance of the tip above the substrate. It's e to the minus 2 alpha z factor that we've talked about many times. This parameter alpha is related to the height of that barrier. Call it the apparent barrier height. It's often abbreviated as phi. And the question is, what is that apparent barrier height, right? Does it make sense for two metals that are separated by 5 angstroms, one from another, two metal surfaces? So the way to sort that out, of course, is you have to measure the current as a function of Z. If you measure the current as a function of Z, then you can get some information about the exponential function. And in particular, you can extract out a value for alpha. So to do that experimentally, what you have to do once you measure current versus Z, what you do is you take the natural log of both sides of that top equation, and then you're plotting the log of the tunnel current versus the tip sample separation that you control experimentally, right? And it's often, in the literature, it's often convention to express the height of the tunnel barrier not in joules but in electron volts. And it's often convention to express Z, the distance between the tip and the substrate, not in meters but in angstroms. So to make those unit conversions, you have to put in the appropriate scale factors. And what I show there is that if you evaluate all those numbers in red, right, the third line on that slide, I put a bunch of numbers in red. If you just sit down and evaluate those numbers in red, you get a number that's about 1.03, right? So that implies that the natural log of the tunnel current is equal to a constant, which is this natural log of I naught that we're not terribly interested in, minus 1.03 times the square root of the barrier height measured in electron volts times the tip sample separation Z measured in angstroms. And so if you're interested in the height of the barrier, then you have to take the derivative of the natural log of I with respect to Z. You've got to square it to get rid of that square root on the right-hand side of the equation. And at the end of the day, if I did all my arithmetic right, you'll find out that the barrier height in electron volts is equal to a number which is about 0.94, given the units that we've discussed, times the derivative of the natural log of I with respect to Z quantity squared. Okay? So very often in the literature, you'll just see this last equation written down, right? This is where it comes from. So how well does this simple model compare to experiment? Well, in the early days of STM, the comparison between experiment and theory was pretty bad. The barrier heights that people would extract from experimental data, the experimental data is just to take the tip and slowly move it towards the substrate. And as you slowly move it towards the substrate, you measure the current. Every time you step the tip closer, you measure the change in current. When you do that, of course, you'll get a curve that increases exponentially with distance. That's indicated in the top panel of this set of data that I took from Biesenbacher's famous paper in 1996. Right, you can see that the tunnel current goes up exponentially as Z gets smaller. In the early days, when you analyzed data like this, you found that these apparent barrier heights were on the order of 1 electron volt, really small. Most work functions in metals are on the order of 4.5 to 5 eV. And so the question is, what's going on? Why is the tunnel barrier so small? Why isn't it comparable to the work function of metals? So Biesenbacher's group did a very careful, thorough study to sort out this problem. he was the first person to explain to me what the difficulties were, so I reference his paper. There's other papers out there that I think come up with the same conclusions. But his point is that if you do the experiment carefully in ultra-high vacuum, you take care to prepare the tip so that it's clean. You take care to prepare the substrate that it's clean. And you measure the logarithmic dependence of the current as you approach the tip to the substrate. You do get data that follows a straight line. It's indicated in the middle panel. And from the slopes of those straight lines, you can back out work functions, apparent work functions, apparent heights for the barrier. You'd like to believe those apparent heights for the barrier are comparable to the work functions of the metals that are involved. And so he's if you read his paper, right, you'll find that you're getting barrier heights on the order of 3.5 to 4.5 electron volts, which is a lot more reasonable than a half EV or one EV that was obtained in the early days of scanning tunneling microscopy. Right? So this technique does work. It requires, again, care and attention to a lot of details. But if you make that effort, you can evidently get apparent barrier heights that make some sense. They don't offend your sensibilities. So if you're interested in this, you can read his paper. The other problem that concerned a lot of people in the early days of STM was why in the hell does this thing work? Because if you just sit down and do a back-of-the-envelope calculation of the electric field that develops between the tip and the substrate, you'll find out that these electric fields are enormous. They're on the order of 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th volts per meter. And whenever you get electric fields that big, you actually start to rip atoms from the tip or from the substrate. Those electric fields are so intense that I'm sure none of you have ever experienced them in real life. Typically electric fields that you see, I suppose if you're in the middle of a cornfield in Indiana on a hot summer day and a thundercloud rolls over, you'll get electric fields on the order of 10 to the 7th volts per meter. But that's still a factor of 10 to 100 smaller than the electric fields that develop when you bring this sharp tip close to a substrate. So the question is, why doesn't the tip atoms just get ripped off in the process of applying a bias voltage between the tip and the substrate? And to answer that question, you have to start to ask questions about what's the strength that holds the atoms together, okay? How strong are the atoms held together? And that involves an understanding of the tip-substrate interactions, right? Because the tip atoms will interact with the substrate atoms. And also, the tip atoms are going to interact with the atoms on the tip. So there's atom-atom interactions. All that has to be taken into account in order to understand whether that tip is going to destroy itself. Now, any of you that have done STM know that if you apply a bias voltage on the order of 2 volts or so between the tip and the substrate, you'll know that your tunnel current starts to get very unstable. And the reason it gets unstable is when you start to apply something on the order of 2 volts, right? The electric fields in that tunnel junction are high enough that they'll actually rip the substrate or rip the atoms off the tip, right? So if you stay below a volt or so, you're in pretty good shape, but you get above 1.5 to 2 volts, you start to get into instabilities. So how would you measure this force that the tip atoms feel as they're brought close to a substrate? That was a big question in the mid-90s. And I refer you to a paper by Cross and his co-workers published in 1998. The idea they had was to bring an STM tip and approach a thin microcantilever. Microcantilever's got a gold film plated on it so that when the tip approaches that gold film on the cantilever, there's a tunnel current that's set up. And that tunnel current is just normal STM operation, right? Just everything we've been talking about for the last 3 weeks. But if there is a force between the tip and the substrate, right, that force will cause the cantilever to bend if the cantilever is floppy enough. And then by measuring the bending of the cantilever, you can infer what the forces are if you know something about the geometry of the cantilever. So you can go back to your elementary mechanics textbooks and you can find out that, for instance, if you can measure the angle that the cantilever bends, that angle is theta. It's often easier to measure the angle that the cantilever bends than it is to actually measure the displacement of the cantilever, which I call delta in this slide. If you can measure that angle theta, and if you know the geometry of the cantilever, you can get the spring constant of the cantilever, which is K. You got to know the length of the cantilever, that's L. Theta is the bend angle, right? And so if you can measure the bend angle for a given tunnel current, right? If you measure the bend angle for a given tunnel current, then from that bottom formula, you can work backwards and infer the force that the tip atoms exert on that gold substrate. So that was the idea, okay? That was the idea, and of course, I wouldn't be up here talking about it unless they were successful in pulling it off, right? So this was their data from 1998, and what they did is they systematically varied the tip position above the substrate by half a nanometer, or actually by plus or minus 1 nanometers, right? So they have a reference, a tip sample separation reference. It's an arbitrary zero because in principle you never really know how far the tip is above the substrate. You can't go in and see that accurately. So they have an arbitrary reference which they call zero. And as they pull the tip away from the substrate by about a nanometer, the tunnel current decreases exponentially with position. And what they find is they find that the cantilever bend decreases also, and the force on the cantilever bend goes to zero to the leftmost side. As they push the tip closer to the gold substrate, the tunnel current goes up exponentially with distance. And as the tunnel current goes up, they find that the cantilever also bends, right? And the bending turns into initially it's an attractive bend, and then it turns into a repulsive bend as you bring the tip very close to the substrate. Right, so this was one of the first efforts made to try to understand the forces exerted by the tip atoms on the substrate, and the numbers that they got were on the order of nanonewtons. You know, the forces were on the order of 0 to 5 nanonewtons, either attractive or repulsive, right? Which means that As you approach the tip to the substrate, initially the substrate atoms sort of pucker upwards, right? And then as you continue to push the tip closer to the substrate, then the substrate atoms get repelled from the tip. That's what this attractive and repulsive regime indicates in this slide. Okay. Peter Grutter and his students up at McGill University did this experiment again in 2005. Now, 10 years later, they did it a little bit more carefully, right? And I indicate their data here because this data starts to show a hysteresis in the forces that the tip exerts on the substrate. It's difficult to go through all the features that are present in this data, but I think it's important to know about this paper because what this paper nicely demonstrates is that the tunnel current actually saturates as you push the tip towards the substrate. You'll see here this on the bottom right-hand panel of this slide, the current is labeled on the right-hand axis. The forces that they infer are given on the left-hand side of the axis. And what you see is that as you push the tip towards the substrate, the current actually saturates, which basically means that your tip is touching the substrate. You've got a physical electrical contact now between the tip and the substrate. As you push the tip in closer, that contact doesn't change a whole lot on a logarithmic scale. And then as you withdraw the tip, from the substrate, notice how the current stays essentially flat, right? Now, the only way that can happen is if there's a bridge of atoms between the tip and the substrate that form, right? There's a little neck of metallic atoms that form between the tip and the substrate. And that neck of metallic atoms causes the tip to adhere to the substrate, okay? And it produces this very hysteretic current versus tip sample separation curve, okay? And, of course, any of you that have done AFM understand this intuitively, because very often your tip will adhere to your substrate, and you're seeing nothing more, nothing less than that here with a scanning tunneling microscope. So that whole topic will come up later when Professor Rahman discusses adhesion effects. But the forces that are exerted are on the order of nanonewtons. That's the key realization, right? It's on the order of nanonewtons for tunnel currents that we typically use in an STM experiment. There's been some effort to understand the mechanical instability of tips in substrates, and this is Chen's work from his very nice book on Introduction to Scanning Tunneling Microscopy. Right, he's actually calculated the displacement of tip atoms and substrate atoms as a function of tip-substrate separation. And so what he's got on the right-hand side of this slide is he shows how the tungsten tip atom displaces as you move the tip towards a gold substrate. So initially the tungsten tip atoms pull away from their equilibrium lattice constants, right? That's indicated by that upward rising curve, which is labeled with the tungsten tip. And gold is much softer than tungsten, so the gold atoms actually pull away much further, about a factor two further than the tungsten atoms. And so the apparent tunnel gap, right, the apparent tunnel gap is going to be modified by those displacements of the tip and substrate atoms, right? And when you start to pull within, 0.35 nanometers, 3.5 angstroms, when the tip-substrate separation gets to be about 3.5 angstroms, you have to add those two curves together, and you start to get a reduction in the tunnel gap for this particular tungsten gold system, something on the order of maybe 75 picometers, right? Just due to the relaxation of the atoms on the tip and the substrate. So this was one of the theoretical calculations that I found that's, I think, kind of easy and intuitive to understand. You can see that the relaxation goes from a positive value to a negative value as you push the tip closer to the substrate, right? That indicates that you're starting to indent and compress both the tip atom and the substrate atoms, right? And the indentation can be on the order of picometers also. Clearly these tunnel junctions are dynamic, right? They're dynamic in STM. We know that. Anybody that's done STM knows they're dynamic. They're also dynamic in AFM, and that'll come out in the next couple weeks as Professor Rahman continues this discussion, for us. Okay? So I wanted to say something about the stability of those junctions. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the corrugation of these images, right? So in the early days, everyone was excited that they could see atoms on substrates, right? And the literature is full of pictures that show nice periodic arrays of atoms. But after the original enthusiasm and excitement wore out, people started to ask, well, exactly how high is an atom in an STM image, and does that height of the atom match what you would expect theoretically based on your knowledge of the electronic structure of, let's say, a particular surface? And so this whole area comes under the generic name corrugation, atomic corrugation, which is just a fancy way of saying how high is an atom. And again, if you look in the late 90s, you'll find dozens of papers that address this issue. I picked one out from Wiesendonger's group in Germany that's really very nice. So they looked at tungsten, tantalum, and iron surfaces with an STM tip. They picked particular orientations of these surfaces. So they looked at single crystals that were oriented in a 110 direction. This was all ultra-high vacuum work. And from these images of the atomic lattices on these different metals, right, you can draw a line and you can measure the height profile, and that's indicated by the sinusoidal pattern on the right-hand edge of this particular view graph. And you can see that the corrugation, the distance from up to down, along one of those profiles is on the order of 150 picometers, about 0.15 angstroms or so, right? That's roughly the distance between the ups and the downs. And so, you know, you can measure these things accurately, and you can start to ask, how do they compare to theory? Of course, one thing you'll quickly find if you do this work very carefully is you'll find that the answer you get for the corrugation of the atoms, that answer depends on the bias voltage that you apply. Okay? And the reason it depends on the bias voltage that you apply is because STM is fundamentally a local density of states map. It's only a height map if the local density of states is constant. Okay? So if you have an atomically smooth substrate, and you start to apply different bias voltages, and you start to look at the shape of the atoms, the apparent shape of the atoms, you'll find that the apparent shape changes depending on what bias voltage you're on, because you're just looking at different density of states for the different bias voltages. So this is very nicely illustrated by this diagram, which shows that if you measure the corrugation of these atoms at different voltages, not only does the corrugation change, the apparent height of the atom is different, but the shape of the atoms, right, the symmetry of the atomic features also starts to vary with bias voltage. And the question is, how well is all that understood?
The scale on those inset images is about an angstrom or something?
Yeah, the scale is about an angstrom by an angstrom. I'd have to go back and look at the paper, but those are basically pictures of one atom. Okay. Basically pictures. They're a picture of that unit cell.
Right.
Probably that's probably 3 angstrom by 3 angstrom image. Okay. So you're really asking tough questions now, right? What is the shape of an atom and how high is it? And, again, I can't go through all their results in detail, but I take the main image from their paper that hopefully you'll remember a few weeks from now. So this is the measured corrugation for different distances between tip and sample. Okay. And the solid lines are predictions, and I think the symbols are data points, right? And what they show that the apparent corrugation, the importance of this image, of this data, is it shows that the apparent corrugation depends on the atomic symmetry of the tip atom that's conducting the tunnel current. So if you look, they've got tip atoms where they assume that the electrons responsible for the tunnel current are S electrons, PZ electrons, or the DZ2 electrons. These are the atomic states that are characterizing the atoms at the end of the STM tip. And the apparent corrugation that they measure depends on what that atomic state is. And so they can, by fiddling around, by playing games, they can capture the tip in these different corrugation states. When they measure the different corrugation states, they get this data, and they try to get the data before the tip wave function changes, right? And then they go and they do a theoretical calculation about what the corrugation should be, assuming these different tip states, and the agreement between theory and experiment, at least on a log scale, right? At least on a log scale, that agreement's pretty good. They certainly get the overall trends properly. So if you want to make the effort, you can actually understand how high an atom is in an STM image, right? And you can understand it quantitatively. So very nice piece of work. Very, very careful. Okay. Last topic is a brief discussion of quantum corrals. This is a topic that emerged maybe 4 or 5 years ago in the early 2000s. It's basically driven by the work at IBM Almaden and Stanford University. And it's just a really beautiful example of the precision that STM can achieve in fabricating structures and then measuring the electronic states that are generated by these fabricated structures. So basically, what is a quantum corral? In five lines or less, quantum corral is some sort of an artificial structure that you construct to confine electrons in a way that they're not normally confined, right? So you have to create some sort of an artificial structure, and that artificial structure has to be efficient at confining electrons. The corrals usually are constructed on atomically flat metallic substrates, right? So the substrate has to be metallic and it has to be flat. Essence of a quantum corral is an electron state that is localized on the surface of the metal. So these are surface states that we're looking at. They're not the bulk electron states that we talked about two or three lectures ago. But it turns out a lot of the metals have these surface states located on them. And I think the example I'm going to show is a copper surface. So these surface electron states are there. They're states that just run parallel to the surface. They don't propagate into the metal surface. What you do to make a quantum corral is you construct from atoms a fence. Right? You make a fence of atoms, and these fence of atoms is then very efficient at electron scattering. And what the quantum corral demonstrates is that there is a way to transmit information across distances in a metal that does not require wires, right? You can actually just, if you understand it, you can actually use the wave functions of the electrons themselves to transmit information across a distance without the requirement for wire interconnects. So it's a new way of guiding information through solids. And the basic idea is illustrated on the bottom part of this slide. You probably have seen this in your introductory physics classes, right? If you have an incident wave, plane wave, that strikes a scattering center, that incident wave is scattered in an isotropic fashion from that scattering center such that new wavelets are produced at the center of that scattering center. And these new wavelets then emanate from the scattering center in a spherically symmetric way that I've tried to indicate schematically in that diagram. And the idea is if you arrange these scattering centers in intelligent ways, then you can cause constructive or destructive interference of that scattered wave from each scattering center. And this constructive or destructive interference can set up standing wave patterns, right, that persist over, that are independent of time as long as your incident wave is persistent. So that's the basic idea. In this example, the incident wave is basically going to be the electron surface states on a metal surface. And these scattering centers are going to be atoms that are arranged with an STM tip into a pre-described shape. So what you have to realize is that ellipses are special. The shape of an ellipse is very special when you're thinking about scattered waves. And this was demonstrated back in 1825 by some Germans who took an elliptical bowl, filled it with mercury. Right? Now, a property of an ellipse is that there are two points in the ellipse called the foci of the ellipse. And if you make a disturbance at one focal point of the ellipse, precisely at the focal point, then that wave disturbance propagates outward, reflects from the boundaries of the ellipse, and is then refocused at the second focal point of the ellipse. And so in 1825, what they did is they took an elliptical bowl, filled it full of mercury, and then they carefully dropped little drops of mercury at one focal point. When that drop of mercury lands on the surface confined in this elliptical pattern, in this elliptical shape, it generates an outward going wave. That outward going wave scatters from the elliptical boundary of the bowl, and it's refocused at the other ellipse. Right? And so if you can imagine dropping a steady stream of mercury drops that fall onto one focus of the ellipse, then at the other focus of the ellipse, you'll find that these wavelets that are generated recombine, okay? And this is a sketch, right? This is a sketch of what these guys saw in 1825 of this whole phenomenon, right? You just do it, and you can look at it, and if you're a careful drawer, you can make a picture that looks like this, okay? So the thought is, why not try this with a quantum corral, right? And this result was published in Nature February 2000. This comes out of Eigler's group at IBM Almaden. And what they did is they arranged 36 cobalt atoms to form this elliptical structure. And then they watched how the electron, these surface electron states that are propagating on the copper 111 substrate, how those electron states scatter from that elliptically shaped quantum corral of 36 cobalt atoms. And those ripples that you see in the middle of this image are the constructive and destructive interference of these surface states as they bounce around and reflect off those that elliptical shape of the 36 cobalt atoms. And then to mimic the experiments that probably are obvious to everyone by now, they carefully placed another cobalt atom at one focal point of the ellipse, and then they carefully looked, and sure enough, the electron character of the waves that were scattered from that one electron state, from that one cobalt atom placed at the focal point of the ellipse, the character of that electron state was reformed at the other focal point, as indicated by that small purple-colored region, right? So they call this a quantum mirage because there's really no atom present at the focal point on the lower image of this corral. The electron states that are reflected from the atom placed at the focal point in the upper right portion of this corral are reflected from the elliptical shape of the corral and reconverge and form the so-called image of the atom, okay? So it's a beautiful demonstration. It requires a lot of expertise just to make the corral, and that takes time.
This is kind of normal topography scanning.
I think this is a artist conception of what's going on. If you want the details, okay. If you want the details, you got to look. And I looked at Feide and Heller's paper, Reviews of Modern Physics. They actually worked out the theory and compared the theory to the experiment, right? So first, let's just do the empty corral. The corral without any atoms placed at the focal point. right? So the top image is the topography, right? What you would expect theoretically, taking everything into account that you can possibly take into account. And then on the right is what you would measure experimentally. And you can see those ripples, right? The ripples inside the corral are produced by the surface electron states that are bouncing around inside the corral. And they produce this characteristic ripple pattern. And you can see, you can't see that ripple pattern except if you use STM, right? It's very, very tiny, right? But you can measure it with STM. And you can see that the experiment in theory agrees quite well. And then what's more interesting is if you take the, make a density of states plot, right? Because experimentally that's what STM is measuring, density of states, right? Measure density of states plots, function of X and Y. Again, you got a theory and an experiment, right, for an empty corral. And what you'll notice is that theory predicts depressions, dark spots at the focal points, and those dark spots in the focal points are actually measured experimentally. So that means there's a deficit of electrons at the focal point of that ellipse when there's no atoms present, okay? When there's no atoms present. If you then drop an atom in, the situation changes. So again, the top two panels on this slide show the topography, right? So the topography is very clear. The white spot at the focal point is an indication that an atom has actually been placed there. Okay, an atom has actually been placed there now, and it modifies the topography of the interference pattern a little bit. If you go back and forth between this slide and the previous slide, you can see subtle differences in the topography between the two images. But when you look at the density of states is now modified enormously. In fact, you can see that hole that was on both sides of the ellipse before, that hole has now disappeared. There's now a high density of states associated with the placement of that atom at the ellipse, and that density of states is then reflected and combined and refocused onto the focal point on the left-hand side. The reconstruction of the density of states is not perfect because there's scattering processes involved in this this process, right? The electron states don't live forever, and if they did, then I think you would get an exact mirror image on the left compared to the right. Okay, that's my understanding. So it's a little bit more complicated than this because cobalt is a magnetic atom, and so there is an interaction between the magnetic state of the electrons, the spin of the electron, and the magnetic atom of cobalt. That's discussed in much more detail in Feide and Heller's paper. So if that's of interest to you, you have to go and actually read their very nice theoretical understanding of this. Okay. If you like to see simulations on the web, I was looking around this summer and I actually found a web page that allows you to simulate these quantum corrals. So if you go to that web page, you can watch how these things develop in right before your eyes. So I think I'm about done summarizing scanning tunneling microscopy, and I'd like to summarize, right? We had to go very quick. I tried to hit the high points. I tried not to tell too many lies so that you have a sense of what's important and what's not. And what you realize after you do this scanning tunneling microscopy for a number of years is that to really do it well, you need very flat substrates. They have to be electrically conducting, and they have to be well characterized. So they can't be changing as you do the experiment. They have to be reasonably stable. That's what I mean by well characterized. The best experiments are done in ultra-high vacuum and at low temperatures. If you do not have UHV and low temperature STM, you're probably not competitive with the best groups in the world. The experiments require lots of time and money. The equipment is not cheap. It's $1 million plus to build nowadays. And it often takes 4 or 5 years just to custom build an STM chamber to do a certain type of experiment. You really need a lot of infrastructure to make these experiments work, so you need a group. You need an extended group of students and postdocs that stay with the lab for long periods of time, right? Because the tricks that are learned have to be passed on to the newer students. And if you're constantly losing students and not maintaining them, it's really tough to do these state-of-the-art measurements. And then lastly, you really need some good theoretical support, because ultimately you have to be able to do these density of states calculations to compare theory with experiment. So if you're not working with a talented theorist or talented theoretical group, it's tough now. Right. In the early days, it was okay, but now it's a different ball game. So that gets us to about 1986 in the timeline. So we've gone from like 1981 to 1986, five lectures. If you come to the next lecture, we're going to start to talk about the transition from STM to AFM. All right, so I'm just going to give a little historical perspective. Having lived through that period, I can talk about what it was like. I'll give a little historical perspective on Thursday's lecture, and then I will turn the floor over to my esteemed colleague, who will tell you everything you need to know about AFMs. So that's all I have for today. Okay, if you have any questions, be happy to answer them. Yeah.
So a lot of the discussion here is focused on flat conducting surfaces, and there's been a lot of recent use of STM for some really recent hot areas like molecular electronics, right? Where instead of a crystal, you've got molecules, and you're looking at conduction. I mean, that seems to be a very hot in area for STM, right? How does that differ from
that? So the question is, how do you use STM to study the properties of molecules on substrates? So when you put a molecule on a substrate, how high is the molecule above the substrate? Anybody have an idea how high a molecule is?
What kind of molecule are we talking about?
Benzene molecule. Yeah, I mean, you have to have a sense of the scale of things, right? Molecules, the thickness of molecules, I mean, unless it's a protein or DNA is a nanometer high, but proteins can be 10 nanometers high, but individual molecules like benzene are on the order of a half a nanometer high. So if you lay a benzene molecule on a substrate, and you want to see where that benzene molecule is, then the substrate had better be flatter than the corrugation that the molecule was going to introduce, right? Now, a half a nanometer is still what I would consider to be a flat substrate, right? When I'm talking about substrates that are not flat, I'm talking about substrates that have corrugations on the order of 10 nanometers or so. Right, so if you want to measure something, like take, for instance, a buckyball, you put a C60 molecule on a substrate. Does anybody know what the diameter of a C60 molecule is? Well, that'll have to be a homework problem. I'll have to look that up, right? But if the C60 molecule is, if the height of the C60 molecule is comparable to the roughness of the substrate, you're not going to see it. I mean, you won't be able to conclusively convince yourself that it's there. I mean, you always get an image, right? You can always draw a circle around some feature that you can then label and say, well, here's the buckyball, but is it convincing or not, right? So when I'm talking about flat substrates, what I really mean is I'm saying that the substrate has to be flat, flatter than the objects that you're adding to the substrate that you're trying to image. And so, for instance, if you put benzene molecules down on a gold 111 surface, you can see them because gold 111, when prepared properly, is atomically flat. There will be terraces. Terraces are on the order of 3 angstroms high, but the terraces follow straight lines, and you can clearly resolve those terraces with respect to, let's say, a hexagonal benzene molecule, right? What is the main influence that the benzene molecule causes when it's deposited on the substrate? It modifies the surface density of states. So if you try to measure the height of the benzene molecule on a flat substrate, the height that you get, that your STM tells you, that height may not be the actual geometric height. It's a mixture of height plus density of states. And so to understand, to deconvolute all that information, you've got to start to do model calculations for how the benzene electron states in benzene couple to the electron states in the surface that you put it on, right? Can be done. People do beautiful work that way, but it involves a very tight coupling between theory and experiment. You have to have pretty good theory to sort all that out. Okay. Does that kind of answer your question? So I probably should qualify that. It's when I say flat, I should say flat with respect to what you're trying to look at. Okay. Nothing else? Okay, great. So we'll see everybody Thursday. Start to talk about AFM.